Now we're doing Shemos. Question's been raised with regard to Moshe Rabbeinu at the burning bush, whether this was the first time he had received a prophecy from God. It's not an easy question to answer. It would seem that way in terms of the following the plain story. The Torah doesn't seem to be recording any other prior incident in which God had appeared to him. So in terms of the overt narrative, it would seem that this is the first. And the question's being raised that it seems strange that the very first communication from God is directing Moshe to assume this mission. That would determine the whole course of Jewish history, the receiving of the Torah, and so forth. If that is the case, that it is the first one, then I really, there's not much that I could say. Things may seem one way, they may seem strange, but you have to go beyond that and recognize what is the problem, though. That apparently Moshe had reached a level where this wasn't the highest level of prophecy he was going to attain. That's a separate point, that in this particular prophecy, Moshe is receiving the communication in the way that all the prophets do, through an image, through a prophetic vision, the vision of the burning bush, and so on and so forth. Of course, God communicates to him, and we're told the nature of the communication. But as the Rambam explains in the Mora, all of the prophets don't receive direct communication, except for Moshe. And Moshe Rabbeinu at this point in time had not reached that level of direct communication. So therefore, the vision contains certain images, allegories, images, and so forth, and the prophet has to interpret them, has to, so to speak, decipher them. So when we read it, and what we're reading is that God is addressing Moshe and telling him that he's heard the plight of the nation, the screams of the nation from their labor, and now I'm going to go down and I'm going to redeem them and take them to the land and so on and so forth. That's what we're reading, is the communication after it's been deciphered by Moshe. The Torah does not communicate in this case the images that Moshe saw. But we know that this is a classical form of prophecy. And later on, Moshe reached the highest level where it says that God spoke to him face to face, so to speak, direct communication, as one person communicates with another person, and not through images. Now, with regard to the question that it would seem strange that the very first instance of prophecy would be conveying this kind of a message, I don't see why that's necessarily a problem, other than that we're not accustomed to that. I assume that the question is based on the idea that there should be some development, some process of development, whereby a person is brought along to a higher level, and when he reaches that level, then he's deemed to be appropriate for the mission. But it doesn't have to be that way. It's clear that we don't know what the requirements were, but Moshe met those requirements. In fact, a lot of the dialogue has to do with Moshe's resistance, which is an amazing part of the story. The extent of the resistance that Moshe Rabbeinu displays. And let me raise an issue with regard to that. Question that I raised this Shabbos, this past Shabbos, when I spoke about the Parsha. I raised this question. I'd like to address it to you. It seems to me that I had never heard this question before. It's a very, very simple, very, very basic question. So sometimes we overlook the most basic questions. And that is, let's take a look at the objections of Moshe that are recorded in the story at the burning bush.
Actually, Rashi.
Now, before we go to the burning bush, we're going to take up the Rashi, which indicates that Moshe Rabbeinu did have the prophetic spirit prior to the revelation at the burning bush. And that is in the story of the second day. The first day Moshe went out, actually it was the first day. The first day that Moshe went out, it says that he grew up. This is in chapter 2, verse 10. that he grew up. Verse 11. It was in those days, and Moshe grew up, he matured, and he went out to his brethren. Take a close look at the way the pasuk is structured. He went out to his brethren. It doesn't say he went out to the Jews. So the term brethren is very important over here. And he saw them in their labors. Vayarish Mitzri, and he saw an Egyptian man, Maka Ish Ivri Me'achav, hitting a Jewish man, Me'achav, from his brothers. So it's pretty obvious that we do have a redundancy here. That is, the use of the word Echav, brethren, twice in the same sentence is clearly superfluous. Because we already know that he went out to his brethren. And then it says that there was an Egyptian hitting an Ish Ivri, a Jewish man, Me'echav, from his brethren. So that second one is clearly superfluous. That's one question. Now let me raise another question with regard to what Moshe did. It says, and he looked around. Now, these psukim that we're learning on different levels. There's always the level of the plain, what we call the plain pshat, the plain meaning of the text, which is, in fact, recording what actually happened. Except the Torah is constructed in such a way that deeper meanings are embedded in the text. So you have a midrash, and the midrash is an allusion to something. But when you read the midrash, it seems like the story is changing, like something else happened. But that is not the case. It means that within the description of the basic event, deeper ideas are being alluded to. So there's truth in the midrash, but it's not the literal truth of what happened. So it says he looked around, Vayar ki ein ish, and he saw that there was no man. Vayachas ha-mitri, and he smote the Egyptian, Vayitmaneh bachol, and buried him in the sand. Now, the plain meaning is Vayifen kol bachol. He looked all around. That means, physically speaking, he looked around to see that if anybody was around to observe what he was doing, because he didn't want to get caught. So had he seen anybody, he wouldn't have done this. What would he have done? I don't know. But he wouldn't have killed the Egyptian, because obviously he didn't want to be caught. So he looked around and he saw that they were alone, so that he could do it, hopefully, and get away with it. As we will see, there was nobody around, and yet he didn't get away with it. The word got out. But nevertheless, at the time, Moshe thought that he would get away with it. So it says he saw that there was no man. Plain meaning is, as we've said, there was no Egyptian around. Now take a look at Rashi. Rashi says, Vayar ki ein ish, he saw there was no man, she'ein ish lotzeis mimenu, she is gayer. There was nobody destined to descend from this individual who would convert. That is the midrash, which is, now you can see an illustration of how the deeper idea is embedded. And both are correct. That is, on the level of the narrative, it's referring to anybody else that would have deterred him from killing. So that ish, that person, would have been an observer, a different Egyptian. But also, there was another consideration. This midrash is saying that Moshe Rabbeinu looked into the possibility of there being another individual who would serve as an impediment to his killing the Egyptian from a different standpoint, and that is, was there any ish, was there any man in the future, a future individual? Now, this, of course, can only be with prophetic spirit. It's referred to as Ruach HaKodesh, the Holy Spirit. So I'm mentioning this because of the question, was the burning bush the first occasion of prophecy? Here we see that Moshe Rabbeinu, according to this midrash, not the plain meaning of the story, had some type of a prophetic insight with regard to the future. Before we answer this question as to the significance question is, let's assume that he would have seen that there was some individual in the future destined to convert to Judaism. What would he have done then? We have to assume that the course of action that he took was the correct one, and it would seem that when we engage in certain types of action, certainly in terms of helping others, we have to act on the basis of the situation now. And we can't take into consideration the future. We don't know. We don't have access to the future. But when we fight against wicked people, we fight against Haman, we fight against Hitler, and so on and so forth. But we don't know, if we kept them alive, who's destined to emerge. I don't think we would find it relevant not to destroy a wicked person, because a few hundred years later, if we allow him to live, he'll sire a righteous person. We have to enact justice in terms of the situation now. A person is wicked, a person's a murderer, he has to get his punishment. So what's the implication over here? But also, let's ask a different question. And what was Moshe trying to accomplish with this? It would seem that Moshe was concerned about his brethren. He wanted to study the situation and find out what had taken place, the nature of the situation, the injustice. Was it something the Jews had brought about by themselves through their own mistakes? Did it indicate some type of a wickedness in the Egyptians? And he wanted to study the situation. That's what apparently it means, that he went out to his brothers, Vayar, to see, to observe the situation. So he saw, according to the simple narrative, he saw an Egyptian getting hit. Is this the appropriate response? Was it just a visceral response? Because you could ask, well, what was he going to accomplish? The real problem is the situation of slavery. And I would imagine he would want to address himself to that. There's always going to be individual slaves who are getting beaten. So to just intervene in one situation and take a big risk, as we see, that was the last intervention as a result of the fact that it was known he had to leave. Why was it so important that he do what he did, that he take this risk? How important was this particular case in terms of the whole problem? When you study an evil that's going on, if somebody was going over to Europe during the time of the persecutions, the Holocaust, so obviously he would see individual cases, but I don't think he would decide what to do or just put everything on the line for one particular case when you have to look at the whole situation. Now, Rashi provides an explanation. This Rashi, I believe, would be a problem in and of itself. On the words, Maka Ish Ivri, hitting a Jewish man. Now, when you read it, the impression is it was just something that happened. Somebody hit somebody. But the term Maka Ish Ivri can be read in the sense of continuously hitting him. He was continuously hitting him, beating up on him. That is, he had targeted him. And he had an objective to finish him off. That's what Rashi says. Malkeu v'rodeu. He was bringing him down. He was assaulting him with a purpose. It wasn't just a haphazard thing that sometimes a worker is slow and he gets a blow. That wasn't the case. It wasn't that kind of a beating. But it had an objective. So Rashi identifies him as being the husband of Shlomis Bas Divri, whom we read about later on in a different context. Now, Rashi provides what would seem to be a very strange background. Why was this Egyptian targeting this Jew? What took place? So Rashi says that he, the Egyptian, had been attracted to the Jew's wife. Her name was Shlomis. And he came to the house at night. He was trying to seduce her. He came to the house at night and removed the Jew from the house. Got rid of him. Sent him on some kind of a job, whatever it is. And then the Egyptian returned and entered into the house and had relations with his wife. And Rashi adds that she, apparently she was a righteous woman, she thought it was her husband. That sounds a little bit strange, but the situation was different. It was dark, whatever it was. Now what happened is the husband came home and sensed what had happened. And then when the Egyptian realized that the husband had found out or had suspicions, he knew what had happened, then he was beating him up all the day. I'm not commenting on the particulars that Rashi mentions. But my question is, why do we need to know this particular background? So what? All we need to know is that there was a Jew who was being assaulted, and Moshe Rabbeinu intervened. In my opinion, this Rashi is very important. Not because of the particulars, how it came about that a particular Jew was targeted. He was targeted because the Egyptian wanted to be with his wife, and he shouldn't find out about it, and now he had found out about it. So he was beating him up. Therefore, this was a matter of a life, of saving a life. It wasn't just a case where whenever you have a system of slavery, so then you always have masters that are tougher, and if they feel a slave isn't moving quickly enough, they could give him a blow. It wasn't a case, as we imagine it, where a master was just giving a blow or two. I don't think that Moshe would have necessarily intervened in that situation. But this was serious. Moshe saw that this Jew was in danger. His life was in danger, and that if he did not intervene, he would die. So that's the motivation. That's what prompted the necessity for action. But the next thing is, does it make sense to just do so, and then he'll get caught, Moshe will get caught, and that'll be the end of him? That is, Moshe could be killed. In fact, that's indeed what happened when they found out that it was Moshe. He had to run away to save his life. As the pasuk says in verse 15, that the Paro heard, and he sought to kill Moshe. So the fact that he was raised by the daughter of Paro didn't help him. Paro perceived him as being a threat. So then it says that Moshe looked around, and he saw that there was nobody there. So he believed that he could save the Jew, whose life was in danger, and get away with it. That's important. Apparently, otherwise he wouldn't have done this. What would he have done? We don't know. But now the question, before we go to the next question, I raised the question on the previous pasuk, the use of the word his brethren twice. And the second one clearly seems to be superfluous. So let's see if we can resolve that right now on the basis of what we said. I would say that it's communicating an idea, something about the greatness of Moshe. In a general sense, the greatness of Moshe is that in spite of his privileged position, he didn't turn his back on his brethren. He knew about his brethren. He was nursed by his mother. So I'm sure they educated him about who he was and so on and so forth. That's clear that he knew that he was Jewish. And in spite of the fact that he could have avoided the entire problem and been separate because he had a privileged position, they were still his brethren. He didn't break the identification. But the pasuk is very subtle. See, it's one thing to maintain the identification to the extent that you're willing to consider the issue and to look into the problem and to study the problem and to see what you could do. That's one level. But what happened was, he saw a particular situation that demanded a response. He saw one of his brethren was in trouble. His life was in danger. And now it was incumbent on Moshe to do something. Thou shalt not stand idly by the blood of your brother. The question is he still my brother? That's the point. That's why it mentions it again. Because it's a different degree of identification, of brotherhood. That very few people in that situation would still retain the bonds of brotherhood. Because now you have to take a tremendous risk. So that's why I believe it mentions that even though he was being beaten, and even though that meant that Moshe would put himself in great jeopardy, he still looked at him as a brother. Now, the next pasuk is that he decided to kill the Egyptian. The killing of the Egyptian was self-defense in order to save the Jew. What is the meaning then of the statement of Rashi, that he had a prophetic insight about the future, and he saw that there was no man in the future, no future man descending from this Egyptian would convert to Judaism. So the question is, what difference does that make? We maintain that a person, when he kills someone, he's liable for taking out that life, but also for the lives of all the future generations that could have descended from this person. So when Moshe made the decision to kill the Egyptian, he took that into consideration, all future generations that might descend from him. But apparently they were not significant enough, even though they would be innocent. They're not guilty. So why are they being deprived of life? Now the answer is because that's the way it goes. When you enact justice against the person, if a person is deserving of death, so then you're not liable for the future generations. You had a right to kill him. Yet if he would have seen through prophecy that there was a great person, I think by the idea of converting, I think it means it's a compliment that shows the level of the convert. The ideal convert is on a very high plane, that someone who of their own volition would recognize Judaism and the Jewish people and would convert to Judaism. So it would be a high level of a righteous person, a tzaddik. And that, had Moshe seen that, then he would have acted differently. It would seem that had Moshe Rabbeinu discovered a righteous person in the future, then he would have acted differently. Otherwise the Medrash doesn't make any sense. So what does that mean? Well, what about the Jew that's being attacked? I don't think it means that if that's the case, he would have abandoned the Jew. Because that's no framework of justice or morality. The obligation is not to stand idly by. So I don't think it means that he would have walked away and allowed the Jew to be killed because of that individual in the future. And we don't function like that. You don't weigh one life against another. When it comes to saving a life, you're not allowed to save one life at the expense of another. That is to kill another person. Let's say that he has a certain organ that's needed by this dying person who needs the organ. And let's say the one who needs the organ, who's sick, is a perfected individual and a gifted individual and a tremendous talent, and does enormous service for mankind. And the other individual is a lowlife, does nothing. So in terms of practical calculations, you'd say, and it certainly makes sense to save the righteous person in terms of all the good that he does at the expense of this meaningless person. I know people don't like to speak about a meaningless person. Yeah, practically speaking, we don't talk that way. But philosophically, that's true. There are many people that pretty much are living meaningless lives. You have Bowery bums and so on and so forth. Not to be disparaging. It's a tragedy and so forth. But I'm just using the term descriptively and philosophically. So if you're going to weigh it, if you're going to say, let's go by a calculus. And this other individual is a great scientist or a great healer, and he provides tremendous benefits for the world. But you can't use that as compelling as it might be from a rational standpoint. From a purely rational standpoint, from a purely humanistic standpoint, that is, people who approach these things not from the standpoint of the divine, then why not? Yet I think that today, the moralists of today, who pretty much reject God, I think that they would not accept this way of thinking. That's because they don't believe that there's an objective good or bad. You can't say that this person's life. Today's way of thinking, this is my impression, is pretty much, it's everything is subjective. So you can't differentiate between what you would consider a very advanced, rational, scientific, moral way of life and someone who's living a meaningless existence, just drinking and eating and indulging his appetites, a low-level existence. Today's philosophical approach would be that you can't differentiate. It's all subjective. However, I would differentiate, obviously, because I'm looking at it in terms of human purpose. I believe there is a human purpose. There is a design. And in terms of achieving a higher level of existence, there's no question that we can differentiate between different individuals. And I'm not talking about in terms of how much talent the person has, because that's out of your control. I'm merely talking in terms of utilization, of fulfillment of your potential. Nevertheless, we can't make these calculations because that's something which wasn't given over to man. The power over life and death, that's from the Creator. And God determines, God has established the terms of existence. And in certain circumstances, He's given us permission to take life, but it's very limited. That is, if we're applying the law, the person is deserving of death according to the fact that he's violated certain divine laws and so on. But in general, you can't make these kinds of decisions and kill someone who's innocent, who's not deserving of death, simply because his life is meaningless and you could save a life which has infinite value. We can't make those judgments. So what's going on over here? Moshe would not abandon the Jew who's in danger right now because of a potential existence. That potential existence is not an existence. But the whole idea doesn't seem to make any sense. Who are you saving? You're saving an existence that doesn't exist.
I mean, he could have also...
I think it means that Moshe Rabbeinu would have made efforts to find a different way. That is, he had a right to kill the Egyptian. That's one thing. Now, just because you have a right to do something doesn't mean it's always the best thing. It's the most efficacious thing. Didn't mean he had to kill him. What he had to do was to save the Jew. And he had a right to do so by taking the life of the Egyptian. That was his right. However, the pasuk is indicating that had there been a different circumstance, had there been overriding concerns in terms of the future, Moshe Rabbeinu would have taken it into consideration and he would have gone to a different extreme. He would have acted differently. We don't know exactly what the alternative would have been because it didn't come to that. Since there was no such factor in the future, he did what he had a right to do. He executed the Egyptian. But the implication is not that he would have abandoned the Jew, but had there been a reason, a motive, to approach it differently and to look for a different way of saving the Jew and not destroying the Egyptian in the process, then he would have done that. Questions being raised whether Moshe Rabbeinu simply got this prophetic insight out of nowhere. Again, we don't know too much about that. But I would say that he was concerned about this, that he put all of his attention into this area. And with the prophetic ability, had a greater insight. But he initiated it, I would say. That Moshe Rabbeinu's thoughts were running along these lines. While we're on the subject, in spite of the fact that Moshe looked around and he saw that there was no man, thus, ostensibly, the situation was safe and Moshe was unobserved when he slew the Egyptian, we're in for a surprise. Because then it says that he went out on the second day. And then he saw two Jews fighting. And he said to the Rasha, why do you smite your friend? He said to the wicked one, why do you smite your friend? Rashi makes an interesting comment. Why do you smite? Apparently the term Lama Saka implies that he hadn't hit him yet, but he was threatening to hit him. He was about to hit him. So Rashi says, even though he didn't hit him, he's called a Rasha by the lifting of his hand. It's interesting because it shows that, again, Judaism is looking at the situation from the abstract, the corruption of the individual. So it's not the landing of the blow per se, but it is the utilization of force, the adoption of that approach to try and impose your will through force. That's what renders the person into a Rasha. Even before he actually lands the blow, it's the decision. It's the corruption of his choice. When he makes the choice to impose his will by force, so that makes him a wicked person. Now, what happens next? We're in for a surprise. And he said, that is the wicked one, who made you into a man who is a ruler and a judge over us? Do you intend to kill me, just like you killed the Egyptian? So it says that Moshe was very afraid, and he said, behold, the matter is known. And that was a surprise, because he thought that the matter was not known, that he had taken pains to hide it. The Kal is correct. It seems that it was from an unexpected source. And that is that the only person that knew about it, only two people knew about it, Moshe and the one that he saved, the Jew that he saved. So it would have had to have been the Jew. According to this, we don't know if the Jew who revealed the secret did so maliciously. It's hard to understand why he would. Moshe Rabbeinu had saved him. Or, as is very often the case, some people have a strange way of keeping a secret. It's very difficult for people to keep a secret. That's an important principle to remember. That whenever you have something which ought to be a secret, and for whatever reason you have to tell it to someone, and you say, and you remind them, or you make them promise that they won't tell anybody, bear in mind that you're exposing yourself to great danger. Because there's an internal conflict. A person always has a tremendous desire to reveal information. That's a very powerful desire. It's one of the hardest things for people to keep a secret. They've got to share it with others. It gives them a certain feeling of importance that, especially if something like this, that something unbelievable happened to them. If something unbelievable happened to them, I've got to tell you what happened. It's very difficult for them to keep it to themselves. If something is important to you, something is significant, it's very, very hard to live with this kind of significant thing and not share it with someone. You have to have someone to share it with. It gives it a certain reality. It's almost like it's not real unless you can share it with someone. So if the secret is of no consequence, so then I guess you could trust people, but then generally speaking, that's not the stuff of secrets. The stuff of secrets is something that is consequential, that would raise eyebrows or people would want to hear about, and you know it. So you're the one that reveals it, gives you a certain feeling of importance. So that's an important thing to remember. And people, generally, when they receive a secret and they say they won't tell anybody, they always have certain exceptions. And those exceptions have exceptions. So eventually it gets out. But the important thing is to remember how dangerous speech can be. And we should be more attuned to that. Very often we take risks with information that's much better off remaining private. And you may say it over in certain contexts because of this emotion. And you may feel that the ones you're saying it to have no connection or whatever it is, it's safe to say it. But in this situation, you learn from here that it's not the case. As a result of this, Moshe Rabbeinu was almost killed. We'll move on now to the dialogue at the burning bush. There's one question that I wanted to ask. That Moshe Rabbeinu's reaction is one of resistance. He doesn't want to assume the leadership. And one of the reasons is that who am I that I should go to Paro and remove the Jews from Egypt? So Rashi explains that he's basically saying that he doesn't have the skills. He's not qualified. Especially since there's going to be negotiations, and Moshe Rabbeinu regarded himself as having a defect in terms of his speech. He had difficulty in speaking. So a diplomat, a statesman, negotiator has to be smooth in terms of speech. So Moshe Rabbeinu basically did not regard himself as being qualified to negotiate with Paro. So let me ask a very basic question. Why was it God's plan that there would be negotiations at all with Paro? And that is, generally speaking, when you negotiate, it's always an indication of a certain weakness. Because you can't impose your will, so you have to negotiate. But those who have the power, obviously, don't have to negotiate. So in this situation, anyone that has that, this is divine power. With all the plagues and everything that God brought down on the Egyptians, so it's clear that God could have removed the Jews immediately, and there would have been no need for any kinds of negotiations. And that would have solved the problem right there. Then you wouldn't need Moshe Rabbeinu to play that role of negotiator. So why did God set it up in such a way that there would be negotiations? Why didn't he just take the Jews out on day one? To put it a different way, if I had that kind of power, I wouldn't negotiate. Let's say Israel today, if I represented Israel and I had that kind of power to bring about everything that we read about, I wouldn't be negotiating with the Palestinians. I wouldn't be negotiating with the Iraqis. I'd give them a warning out of niceness, and that would be the end of that. There'd be no need for negotiations. This gives us a general orientation in terms of what's happening, in terms of the purpose behind the many, many signs, warnings, plagues that are brought down upon the Egyptians. A framework. The objective over here was not simply to obtain the release of the Jews. That could have been done very, very quickly, and that could have been done very, very easily. However, the purpose was that this was a time when God was manifesting his existence to mankind. For the Jews, to set aside the Jewish nation with its particular mission of teaching the world about God. But it was for the whole world. That's what we see. It was for the Egyptians as well. You see many times, I've made this point before, you see many times that when the plagues begin to become more painful, more powerful. And notice also that everything that God did was with mercy and compassion. It was all being done to instruct Paro. The objective being that Paro too should recognize God and that he should do the right thing as a result of the utilization of his own free will. Free will is a foundation for the entire story over here. Everything has to come about through free will. And therefore, if you take a look at Moshe's interaction, at first, he first goes to Paro with talk, with dialogue. He doesn't do any kind of demonstration. He's trying to persuade him on the basis of knowledge, on the basis of ideas. When that doesn't succeed, then he starts with the demonstrations. But at first, it's just demonstrations, which do not inflict any pain upon him. The staff, the snakes, and as I've pointed out, the Egyptians are able to give the impression of duplicating it. And the point is that the reason for that is so that Paro should be able to use his mind to differentiate. It's a higher level of choice when you have to differentiate. And then come the plagues, but the plagues are also demonstrations. But the demonstrations which have a certain effect upon you so that you'll think about it more. And look, too, how gentle they are at the beginning. They're very gentle. For example, the one of blood. It doesn't have that big of an impact. It creates a bit of a imposition. They have to start digging around to get water. But no one dies from that. And then slowly but surely they get more significant, more powerful. The objective of all of them is compassion, to give the Egyptians an opportunity to become aware of the existence of God and that God relates to man and that man has free will. And he's supposed to act in accordance with his knowledge and perfect himself. This explains another interesting dilemma. And that is that on those occasions when Paro can't take it anymore, and, for example, this occurs with the second plague, the frogs, where they had such an impact he couldn't escape from them and he couldn't take the pain anymore. So he calls for Moshe to remove the frogs, and he agrees. Remove the frogs and I'll let the Jews go and worship God. So what happens is that Moshe agrees. Just tell me when. Whenever you set the time, the appointed time, I'll do it. Then what happens is that Moshe gets rid of the frogs. Of course, it's God that does. So Moshe prays to God. God removes the frogs. And then Paro changes his mind. This happens a number of times. And the question is, why was Moshe Rabbeinu giving him that opportunity? Why didn't he use the leverage? Why didn't he say, first you release the Jews, then I'll remove them? He had them. He had them where he wanted him. He had the leverage. He could have said, I will not remove the frogs, or later on, when it's the hail or the other plagues that are too painful. He keeps doing the same thing. He always gives them the opportunity. Why didn't he say, let the Jews go first? The answer is because Moshe Rabbeinu did not want him to be coerced, so that when he would let the Jews go, it wouldn't be as a result of thought, it wouldn't be as a result of choice, of recognition of God, but it would just be a response to unbearable pain. That wasn't the point. Indeed, that's how the Sforno explains the idea that what God says, I will harden his heart. The hardening of the heart. Which is very problematical because it seems to go contrary to what we're saying. If the objective is so that Paro should recognize and release them, so then why would God harden his heart and make it impossible? It would seem to be a big contradiction. But to the contrary, the Sforno explains that that is exactly what's being pointed out over here. That the hardening of the heart is essential in order for Paro to withstand. He has to be given, we don't know exactly what God did, but he has to be given a certain amount of fortitude so that he's not broken by the blows, because the blows themselves would be too painful. And if they're too painful, he would release the Jews, but only do so because of the pain that he couldn't take. So God gave him the ability to withstand the pain so that he still would have to use his mind. The pain itself would cause him to reflect. Reflect on what's going on over here. And think about what Moshe said. And who really controls the universe. To think it through. That was the purpose of the pain. The purpose of the pain was not to make it so unbearable that he must let them go, that he has no choice. If that's the case, then the whole thing is a waste of time. And that's why Moshe Rabbeinu always removed the plague first. Because he wanted Paro to make the decision when he wasn't under the gun. He'd experienced the plague. And many people experience things in life. And when they experience them, it causes them to change their attitude. Because they have an illness, because they're in pain. So they're going to change their ways. They're going to change their eating habits, whatever it is. Whatever's supposedly responsible. And as long as the pain is there, that fortifies their resolve. But then what happens? The pain goes away. When the pain goes away, then they return to their previous emotional attitude. Now is the test. Now, the question is, did the person learn the lesson? Did he internalize the lesson? And now, when the pain is gone, the mind is dictating that he should act in this way. He shouldn't act in that way. That's free will. That's what Moshe was doing with Paro. That he wanted him to make the decision at a time when he was not suffering from the pain. The pain was gone. The frogs were gone. You could rationalize it away. It was just an accident. Or you could internalize the idea and make the decision now on the basis of the truth. It was a situation of choice. That answers my question. That's why a negotiator was needed. A messenger was needed. And you see the compassion that God demonstrated for Paro, for the Egyptians, for mankind, because God sent him the chief of the prophets, no one less than Moshe Rabbeinu, to be his instructor, to guide him, to negotiate, so to speak. That was an integral part of the plan. And that's why Moshe Rabbeinu questioned and resisted, because he did not believe that he had the abilities, that he could be successful at this. And nevertheless, God insisted, and then the plan was modified, that God agreed to let Aharon go. So you had a team in which Moshe Rabbeinu would be the one who receives the messages from God, and the spokesperson would be Aharon. But the point, the necessity for it, was because the objective was not simply the removal of the Jews from Egypt, but rather revelation, that God would reveal his existence in a manner which would give the Jews the opportunity. Two purposes over here: for the Jews to see and to learn the ideas and the lessons, and for the Egyptians as well. In fact, you do see, we'll get into more of that, that you see the servants of Paro at various times argue with him, and Paro himself acknowledges that God is righteous and I'm wrong. And you see later on that there was those who feared the word of God. Where Moshe gave advance warning about the hail, they brought their animals indoors, and their animals were safe from the hail because those people feared God. So there was a process going on which was affecting Paro, the servants, and all the Egyptians, and which had the potential to bring them to a recognition of the truth.